Well, welcome. The tape can be rolled, I guess. My name's Joan Hunt. I'm campus pastor at Portland State University. And we're looking this week at David, that amazing figure in the life of Israel, who was so human and so effective and so important in terms of the role he filled at that time in history in Israel, that Israel never recovered from him. They kind of kept David up treasured David in their hearts and their imagination and memory, and always hoped that there would be another king like David. And the stories about David in 1 and 2 Samuel are so rich that we've been spending some time the past few days looking at several of them, and today we come to another. I'll review the big picture of where 1 and 2 Samuel have been. Scholars say there are two broad strokes in the story of David in 1 and 2 Samuel. The one they call the rise of David, it's the story of how David, who was relatively obscure, eighth son, when seven was the number of completeness, he was the eighth son. He was a shepherd, a menial job. He carried lunches for his brothers who were in the army. He was kind of a nobody. How a nobody who was one of the poor, one of the marginal people in Israel, one of their own, one of the lambs, rose to be someone who was their leader, their shepherd, not just a lamb among the sheep, but a shepherd who could fight off the lions like the Philistines and the other enemies that Israel had, and create a place of safety, of rest from their enemies, a place where they could plant their crops and not be moved, a place where they didn't have to be endlessly guerrillas hiding out in the hills, but would have some peace and stability and could live a good life. And that's what David was able to do. So we saw him fighting Goliath, the chief military representative of the chief military power at the time, and we saw some other incidents of his rise in his friendship with Jonathan, Saul's son. And then the day before yesterday, we brought him to the place where God had achieved for him this success against the enemies, this rise to power, this stability and peace, where people could live in peace together and have their own place. And God blessed David, said, "I brought you this far." Well, David was trying to figure out how to bless God at that point. He was saying, "Here I am now living in a palace here in Jerusalem, and I've got a little moment where I don't have to run out with the troops immediately. I think I ought to build a temple." And God says, "No, you don't need to build me a house. I'll build you a house." And gives David and David's family and Israel through David and David's family a gracious promise that God will never withdraw support and love from them, will always be their God. God says, "You may sin, and I will punish you for the consequences of your sin, but I'm never going to pull the rug out from underneath you. I'm never going to take my part in the relationship away." And that happens in chapter 7. And then, scholars say, the other broad stroke is what happens down here. Now, I've put it as sort of a hill, because one of the interpretations of what's happening in this part of Samuel is that David's reign is proving to be a failure after all. There's actually one scholar who says, in this part David is blessed, in this part he's operating under a curse. Some people, the old way of looking at it is simply to say, well, the big question in this half of the book is who's going to take over after David dies. And so one by one, David's sons get killed off because of sort of a civil war within their family, until there aren't too many choices left, and then Solomon steals the kingship away from one of his brothers, or half-brothers. So that way of looking at the book says this whole thing is about the internecine warfare of who's going to be next. But another way of looking at it, and the way I'm looking at it, is to focus still on David and his family and see how David's personal choices affect not only his public role as king, but also have consequences within his family. This is a story of a public family. It's not just a private family that has no impact on the rest of Israel. It's a public family that has a lot of impact on the rest of Israel. And what happens here is sort of symptomatic of the whole society. And so some of the events as the family of David is looked at. And you know, scholars can't say enough about what wonderful writing this is and what wonderful character portrayal it is and how deep it goes. Some of the events are the one we'll look at today, where David kills Uriah in order to take his wife Bathsheba, and Nathan the prophet confronts him. Between some of David's children, Amnon rapes his half-sister Tamar, who is defended and takes revenge upon Amnon by Absalom. Absalom's rebellion, and finally in 1 Kings, Solomon's coup, the bloodthirsty way he goes about getting the power for himself. We'll be looking at this tomorrow, Absalom. But today we're right here. So this is the big picture. Now, 2 Samuel 11. These two chapters are a kind of pivot. I think it is okay to put this in a hill shape, because right here something happens where you can't say that David goes any higher. This is a moment where a couple kinds of crossings over happen. For one thing, we go from this public man to see something of his interior life, more than we've seen before, the depths of it even. And Walter Brueggemann says that after John Kennedy was assassinated, one of Kennedy's advisors said, "Well, we will laugh again, but we'll never be young again." And Brueggemann says it's this point that's described in David's life. There will be successes, but he won't be young again. So let's look at 2 Samuel 11. We need somebody to read the part of David today. Is there a David in the crowd? Thank you. Okay, David. And will someone read the part of Uriah? This is not that hard. Is there a volunteer for Uriah? Okay, thanks. And we need somebody to be someone who functions as a messenger. I don't think of the story it's always the same person, but we can have one reader read all the messenger parts. Messenger. Great, thank you. Okay. All right, and I'll be the narrator, because that lets me stop now and then to make comments as we go on.
Control.
That's right. Control. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go forth to battle. Why do kings go forth to battle in the spring?
Weather's better.
Weather's better, right. Things are starting to grow. There's going to be something to feed them. Notice, kings go forth to battle. David, isn't David a king?
Yes.
David sent Joab and his servants, the troops, with him, and all Israel. And they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David, isn't he the king? Remained at Jerusalem. What's going on here?
I think he was playing games.
I think David was playing games. I think he was abdicating some responsibility. Why did Israel think it needed a king way back at the beginning of 1 Samuel? Because they wanted their king to lead their battles and beat the Philistines and anyone else who came up, like the Ammonites, who seemed to be a threat to them. So now that David's at the pinnacle of power, he's staying home in Jerusalem when it's spring. This is already a little bit ominous. It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch. He'd been lounging maybe in the heat of the day. and was walking upon the roof of the king's house, that he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, this is the messenger,
"Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?"
So David sent messengers and took her. Apparently there was nothing in that description of who she was that seemed to be an obstacle to him. Notice the woman is described in terms of the men that she belongs to, her father and her husband. And notice that her husband is a foreigner. He's Uriah the Hittite. He's a mercenary, probably hired and working among the Israelite soldiers. Hittite people lived up in Turkey. And they were good fighters, so they often sold their services. And Uriah the Hittite has apparently been long enough with the Israelites that he's got a wife from among the Israelites, daughter of Eliam. Well, so David sent messengers and took her. And she came to him and he lay with her. Now, that verb took is really devastating. Because in 1 Samuel 8, when Israel was telling Samuel, the prophet, why they thought they needed a king, and Samuel was discussing it with Yahweh, Yahweh said, well, I'm supposed to be the king of Israel, but if they want a king, they can try it. I don't like it, but they can try it. Samuel, speaking in that mind, told the Israelites, look, if you want a king, you know, you're going to be able to try that, but this is what kings do. They take, they take, they take, and they take. Samuel said, they'll take your sons and turn them into their soldiers. They'll take your daughters and turn them into their palace menial housekeepers and perfumers and cooks and all that other stuff. They'll take your crops and use it to feed themselves. They'll take your money and use it to raise, to buy their arms and their weapons and build their roads. And after these kings have taken, 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 and taken, you will be slaves. And you were slaves in Egypt, and you want to be slaves again to your own king? You know, you've got to be nuts. You still want to go ahead and try this experiment of having a king? Okay, you know, Samuel did it, sort of an over my dead body kind of thing. And then here we have that ominous verb. David has become the king, and he now takes Uriah's wife. And she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she was purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house. But the woman conceived. And she sent and told David, we need Bathsheba to read here. Which I know I didn't pick one, so go ahead and pick yourself and be Bathsheba.
I am her child.
All right, thanks. That's Bathsheba's only line in the whole story. But it's a very earth-shaking line. I mean, a lot of people's lives have been overturned by unplanned pregnancies. And here we discover that even the kings can be overturned by an unplanned pregnancy. He's a man with so much power, and yet he's powerless over certain things. You might even say certain acts of God. He's powerless over.
Did they not have abortions in those days?
I think it's generally believed that women knew some ways to do abortions, but that wasn't acceptable in Israel. That was something that the other cultures did. Children were gifts in Israel's mind, and so you were not to kill the life that was within you.
I gather that there weren't, at this particular time, that one was really upset.
The what part? I didn't hear
that. I said, thank God there weren't at this time, because it may have upset the line.
Yeah, right, right. Looking at it from New Testament eyes, that's right. Well, actually, this child does die. But you're right, if the child had been aborted, David might not have gone through with marrying Bathsheba. Well, all right, now, what's David going to do? He's going to cover up what he just did. He's going to find a way to make it look like Uriah was the father. And so the first thing he does is he sends for Uriah to come home. We'll read from 7 to 13. So David sent word to Joab. Joab is his hatchet man, his commander-in-chief. He's been working for David for a long time. He's so loyal to David. I mean, you have to think David was an amazing person to inspire such loyalty as Joab has. So David sent word to Joab,
"Send me Uriah the Hittite."
And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people fared and how the war prospered. He was probably interested in all that, but it was still pretense for the moment of what he wanted to get down to. Then David said to Uriah,
"Go down to your house and wash your feet."
Barracks talk. It means your wife is at home, go sleep with her. You know, go have some fun. These men understood each other. And Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. If you're Uriah, aren't you a little bit suspicious at this point? But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. When they told David, this is the messenger again,
"Uriah did not go down to his house."
David said to Uriah,
"Have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?"
Uriah said to David,
"When the ark and Israel and Judah abide in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open field, shall I then go to mine house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As thou livest and as thy soul liveth, I will not do the same."
This David, this king with great power, is reduced here to saying, "Come on, Uriah, go down to your house. Go down to your house. Go down to your house. Why didn't you go down to your house?" Go down to your house. It's almost like he's stuttering, except this happens over some time. But, you know, it's a figure that does kind of make you laugh at how pathetic it is. David, who commands so much power, doesn't have power to make this one thing he desperately wants to happen. And notice right here that, ironically and poignantly, Uriah the Hittite, who's not even an Israelite, is more faithful to the people of Israel than the king of Israel is. Uriah the foreigner says, "Everyone out there is risking their life, and so I'm not going to give up military discipline right now and live at ease here at home while I'm here, not while my buddies are out there risking their lives, putting their lives on the line." But what has David just done? In the first place, he hasn't gone out there with them, and in the second place, he's having a lot of ease back at home. And in the third place, he's encouraging a soldier to break military discipline. So then David said to Uriah,
"Remain here today also, and tomorrow I will let you depart."
So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. And David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank so that he made him drunk. And in the evening, Uriah went out to lie on his couch with the servants of his lord, and he did not go down to his house. Between that night and that morning, in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. Now, in the hand of the man who is to be killed, David sends word about the next cover-up plan. First one didn't work. The second one is going to work. The second plan is that Uriah is going to be placed in a place where he's likely to be killed. David commits these instructions to writing, which would be one way to keep it private, I guess. No one else would see it except Joab, and he trusts Joab. But also, I mean, this is evidence that could incriminate him in court if it ever got out. So you see how desperate David is. And he's kind of trying to find this fine line of who can he trust and how much can he cover up. And he's just behaving terrifically unethically, don't we think? Yes, we do. And so Uriah carries his own death warrant with him. And Joab goes ahead and does what David said. In fact, apparently, if you read a little farther in this section, like after verse 18 and 19, Joab even takes a few military risks, does some foolish things in order to make sure that his master's orders will be carried out. He sends them right up to the wall of the city that they're besieging. And they already knew from their experience recorded in the book of Judges that that wasn't a smart thing to do, because if you send soldiers right up to the wall, then people who are standing on top of the wall can simply take rocks and drop it right on the heads of the people who are down underneath. But Joab goes ahead and does that, militarily questionable, and Uriah is killed. And so Joab tells the messenger carefully what to say. An interesting thing to notice here is that what Uriah tells the messenger to say is not precisely what the messenger says when the messenger gets home. And some commentators make comparisons with how military intelligence always leads to some kind of double talk and covering of asses to make sure that the right people don't get blamed or do get blamed or make accusations against someone else or something like that. So we can read verses 22 on. The messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had sent him to tell. The messenger said to David,
"The men gained an advantage over us and came out against us in the field, but we drove them back to the entrance of the gate. Then the archers shot at your servants from the wall. Some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite."
That's what David has been waiting to hear. I mean, he's probably interested in the rest of the battle, but this is the piece of news embedded in it all. Now, David can breathe a sigh of relief. Now that Uriah is dead, then no one's going to contradict the fact that Bathsheba's pregnancy was from Uriah. Nobody's there to say, "No, wait a minute, I didn't sleep with her when I was on that, when I was on in Jerusalem talking to David about what was happening at the battle." No one will know. So, David's face is protected, his reputation. Not only that, he can look very magnanimous and generous when he takes Bathsheba into his household, this poor destitute woman whose husband was killed in battle that the king had commanded, and the king is going to take care of her now. He'll come out looking even better than he might have looked before, as well as getting the woman who was beautiful. So David says to the messenger, verse 25, David.
"Thus shall you say to Joab, do not let this matter trouble you, for the sword devours now one and now another. Strengthen your attack upon the city and overthrow it and encourage him."
David is saying here, and it's important to tell you what the Hebrew says literally to Joab, "Don't let this matter be evil in your eyes. Don't let this matter be evil in your eyes." So David is saying, this happens in war. Sometimes one person gets killed, sometimes another person gets killed. Uriah got killed. But David telling Joab not to let this be evil in his eyes, I think he's really telling himself. You know, he's only letting himself see this far. I'm not going to think of this as evil in my eyes. Sometimes war kills one person, sometimes war kills another person. The problem is, this is not a matter of war. This is not the result of the random sword falling here or sword falling there, and sometimes you're in a place where you get killed and sometimes you're not. this is a matter of an assassination.
Which is quite a dilemma for the people who know, because he knows.
It could be a dilemma for Joab. We don't know enough about Joab to know if he would have ever thought of using that. And in fact, the way he's told in this story is just he's David's yes man, hatchet man, and so he's implicated right along with David. And is never really taken to task for his the way he just says yes to David all the time. The story's interest is, yeah, that's interesting to think about, the implication of Joab and what his responsibility could have or should have been. The story's going to go ahead and focus on David, because David is where the source of this evil was. David is saying, we're not going to look at this as evil, you and me, Joab. We're not going to look at it as evil. And when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, notice, she's not called by her name, but the narrator kind of wants to remind us of David's sin. When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she made lamentation for her husband. And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. The cover-up seems to have worked. So far, the story. If it stopped there, David need not have gone any further. Let's stop for a minute right at this point and do a little diagnosis of what's happening to David. We're going to use Ed Schrader's crossings model that some of you might have gotten familiar with from hearing Ed in Bible study last week or in one of his sessions this week. He says, look for a diagnosis or a description of the sickness that's going on in the person's life in the story. And look for how it shows itself at the outside level, the level of external behavior and relationships. Look how the sickness is affecting them on the inside in terms of their attitudes or feelings, the messages that they give themselves. And then also be sure to check and see what the God side message or situation is, what the eternal verdict on their behavior would be. So here we've got David. What has he done? What has his behavior been so far?
Adultery.
Yep. Not just adultery, he took her, it was rape.
And murder.
Murder.
Deception.
Mm-hmm. Lying. Cover up. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
He involved his other, he involved Joab.
Right, right. He implicated what he had accomplices.
Yeah, but he caused that Joab to sin as well.
Right. So he brought guilt on someone else as well as himself. What sort of attitude does this indicate on David's part? Why do you think he did what he did, or he thought he could do what he did? What was he telling himself, if he was thinking about it at all?
He was the king.
Yeah.
He could do whatever he wanted.
He was also guilty. He felt guilty. Right? Because he tried to.
He tried to cover it up.
Yeah.
So at some level, maybe he wasn't noticing there was some guilt. I mean, there was something uncomfortable about it.
He felt guilty, and that's why he wanted Uriah to go sleep with his wife.
Right.
If he hadn't felt guilty, it would have just said, oh, sure, I can do what I want, and wouldn't try to cover it up.
Oh, he might have been just...
So he was aware that somehow he was breaking the covenant of fidelity that he had with the people, with Uriah, with Bathsheba. He'd sinned against her. He'd sinned against Uriah by taking his wife, first of all, and by killing him, second of all, He'd sinned against the people of Israel by not being out fighting the battle where he was supposed to be, and by breaking these covenant commandments that they had for life with one another. And then he justified it by saying, I'm the king, I can do what I want, I have the right, I have the power. Maybe I have the right because I have the power.
Is the cover-up more of a personal guilt or a political move to cover this, this public figure rather than
to present himself as king?
Guilty or not, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I don't know either if he felt personally guilty or if he just felt obliged so that he could keep on being king.
Except that he was telling Joab that it's not evil, which is kind of a clue that
yeah.
he was thinking it's evil.
That's right. There's a little more of a hook involved in there than it seems.
Because that's more of a personal issue, I think, that comment.
So there, he has PR concerns. And there's also this personal niggling doubt that he's trying to silence the voice of very much. We're not going to consider this evil in our eyes, are we, Joab? Uh-huh. All right. This is as far as David takes it. And he's very effectively trying to cover up this aspect of it by not making it a matter of public concern anymore, by taking the wife of Uriah now and making her his own wife. I have the right, I have the power, I can get away with this.
But
how far
did
David take it?
Every soldier's wife, every soldier that died didn't pick all
no,
the wives up, so isn't there something going on? The public
well, she was beautiful. I mean, there's a lot of reasons for his doing this. But, the yeah.
Yeah, he didn't really say that his basic problem was his lust.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Well, that would be in the heart, wouldn't it?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm not sure in terms of the story that the story thinks the basic problem was lust. I think lust and murder, I mean, there are several commandments involved here. And maybe you could say that lust was the root one. But in some ways, the root problem is that he's not willing to be accountable to the covenant that he expects all the other people to be accountable to. And therefore, it's okay to take someone else's wife, and therefore it's okay to murder, to try to clean up the results of what you've done, and therefore, and therefore, and therefore. So what I'm saying there is, if you were to take the diagnosis further, which David is not willing to do, there's the matter of sins against other people with whom he is in a covenant relationship as a member of the community of Israel, the second table of the law. So David has broken the second table of the law. By acting out of his lust, by acting out his coveting. I mean, think of all the commandments. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. That's four of the six. Yeah. Four of the seven in that table of the law that he's broken right there. And then what I'm saying is that David has a deeper problem. His problem is not just his unfaithfulness to the other people with whom he's in relationship in Israel, but his unfaithfulness is really to God. He has also broken the first table of the law. He's broken the great commandment, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. And he's shown that he's broken that commandment by the fact that he said, I am king, I can do what I want. Instead of saying, Yahweh is king, and the power that I have been granted is the power to use resources that I have on behalf of the needy, the poor, on behalf of my people. So David has just let himself slip into God's place and say, the power I have is for me. When why God gave him power was for the people. And God's answer to all of this would be what?
Judgment.
Judgment. Displeasure. And you deserve what you have handed out to people. You deserve to die. But David's not going to look at that. He's stopping. Right there, he's got it all covered up. He doesn't need to worry about it, right? Wrong. God is an actor in this story. And what we have next coming up at the end of chapter 11 and 12 is how God intervenes in this story. The end of verse 27. The thing that David had done displeased the Lord. You can't tell from this translation, but the Hebrew is exactly parallel to verse 25. Remember in verse 25, David said to Joab, don't let this be evil in your eyes. Verse 27, this thing was evil in the eyes of Yahweh. And so Yahweh sent Nathan to David. He comes to David in verse 12 and verse 15, Nathan went to his house. And what happens in between is this whole diagnosis gets spelled out for David. And David makes a response to it. So let's look at the first part of Nathan's speech. Can we have a Nathan here? Reading Nathan's part. Thanks, you be Nathan. And David says something here. We'll read 1 through 6. And the Lord sent Nathan to David. He came to him and said to him,
there were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. And he brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children. It used to eat of his morsel and drink from his cup and lie in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him.
And David's anger was greatly kindled against the man, and he said to Nathan,
as the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing. Because he had no pity.
David's used to being a judge, and it is so ironic that he can get up more heat and concern for this fictional character that Nathan has invented in the parable than he can for the real poor man, poor woman, little lamb that he's been involved with in the past couple months. And also think of what kind of move it was on Nathan's part to talk to David this way.
Kind of set him up, didn't he?
He spoke indirectly to the king. That might be a pretty smart thing to do when you're coming to a king to say, you've got to be called to account for your behavior. It's probably a lot smarter to do it that way than more directly. But then the answer he gets from David shows him, I think, that David's basic morality is still available and on track. And so Nathan tries to move the diagnosis this deep. Now this Nathan is bringing the bottom level down to here and going all the way with it. Bathsheba had said in Hebrew two words, I'm pregnant, and that began this whole crisis. Didn't begin it, actually, because David began the whole crisis with his taking. Two words there, though, caused a crisis for David, and what is he going to do? A choice point for David. I'm pregnant, she said. David had to decide how to respond. Two words on Nathan's part in Hebrew, you're the one, you're the man, you're the rich man who stole the poor man's lamb. And now David's at another choice point, another crisis point. But Nathan's not quite done talking to him yet. Now Nathan takes the courage to go on and say it in very plain language, very legal language. He could be the prosecuting attorney. That's the kind of language he's using in this next section. So, speaking for God, Nathan said to David, let's read 7 through 15.
You are the man, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel. I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you out of the hand of Saul. And I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your bosom, and gave you the house of Israel and of Judah. And if this were too little, I would add to you as much more. Why have you despised the word of the Lord to do what is evil in his sight? You have smitten Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and have taken his wife to be your wife, and have slain him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me, and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of his son. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun.
Okay, pause right there. David has heard all this. He's heard the connection that Nathan just made between himself and the rich man. It's not a secret anymore. At least one more person knows it, and the not only is Nathan giving the words of the Lord as the prosecuting attorney, but also the judgment is passed. Evil leads to evil, leads to evil, leads to evil. You've set this train going and it's not going to stop. There's going to be evil in your house. It's going to be the same kind of evil as you've practiced here. People in your house are going to practice it, and it won't be just secret. It won't be able to be covered up. It will be public. People will know about it. It will rip apart your reign and your household. David has another choice point. Why doesn't he just kill Nathan? Shut the prophet up, and then maybe no one would ever know. Maybe no one would ever know.
He finally really knows that God is really in charge.
Yes.
And he says, I have sinned. He knows he's up against a higher power.
David has felt the bottom drop out from under him. He's been pushed into this level of the diagnosis. And his response is, I'm done for. I have sinned. I brought this on myself and on Uriah and Bathsheba and all the people of Israel and my children. And I mean, it has a life of its own, and it's bigger than I ever would have imagined when I wasn't really thinking about anything except how beautiful this woman was and how I had the power to take her if I wanted to. I have sinned, not just against them, but against the Lord in doing this. How does David get the courage to say that?
David is a man after God's own heart. So David always used to put God first, and he just
always puts God first?
Well, he used to always. he did sin though, and
I think the judgment that David is a man after God's own heart is one we make because of what he does in this verse. He doesn't say this verse because he's a man of God's own heart, but because he says this verse, we see that he's a man of God's own heart, if you see what I mean. It wasn't, from my experience of trying to say something like, I have sinned and I deserve whatever you want to send to me. It's not easy to say, and I don't just say it because I'm a woman of God's own heart. It's terrifying to say it because I'm then losing the control. I'm not being the king any longer. And the only reason I can say that and know that it won't only mean death for me is because I have a larger promise from God. That happened in David's story in chapter 7. If we look back at that, chapter 7 in 2 Samuel, the promise that Nathan brought David from God, talking about David's son, and David has taken this for himself, verse 14 and verse 15. God says, I will be his father, the king's father, and the king shall be my son. When he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men. But I will not take my steadfast love from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before you. So the word of punishment and judgment is there, but the steadfast love is going to be there. Nathan just said to David, you haven't shown any pity, any mercy, any compassion, any of what you were obligated to show to people or to God by virtue of the covenant that you are in relationship with them in. But God will show mercy. God does have pity. God will have pity right here now on David, who has sinned. And David has had no pity. But God does have pity and mercy. And because of the covenant, God will not withdraw his steadfast love. And so this side spells out the kind of healing that's available for sinners like David, for sinners like us. For people like us whose pride or power lets us run away with doing things that are irresponsible and don't take into account the covenant we have with God and with other people, the healing is at this deepest level from God's own hand, action, promise, commitment. God sees evil and won't say that it's not evil, but God will also see the one who did the evil and say, you're still my dear child. There are going to be consequences to what you've done. Nathan has described the consequences. Evil will continue in a cycle, but it will be mitigated somewhat. God will do what's possible to do to stop the consequences. Can't erase it all. But even in the results of the evil that's been unleashed, God will not withdraw love, but will be there working with the situation and working for the people in the situation. And so, back to chapter 12. We'll just finish this section. David has just said to Nathan, I've sinned against the Lord in verse 13. And so then Nathan says to David, verses 13 and 14, Nathan.
Who's Nathan?
Yeah, who was Nathan? Well, maybe we need a new Nathan.
The Lord also hath put away thy sin, thou shalt not die.
14 also.
Okay. Howbeit, because of by this deed thou hast given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born unto thee shall surely die.
Oh, here we want the King. We want Revised Standard instead of King James. The more reliable texts say not that the enemies of the Lord have blasphemed the Lord, they named David, because by this deed you have utterly scorned the Lord. The child that's born to you shall die. Then Nathan went to his house. Notice how David was using a passive verb before. He was always saying, well, Uriah was killed by what happens in war. Nathan says, you're the subject of that verb. You killed him. But the Lord has put away your sin. You shall not die. Still going to be a mess because of this. You're going to lose that child. And Nathan went home. Any comments? Yeah.
What's fascinating to me is that nowhere in this whole recital does David or anyone blame Bathsheba.
Right.
No time is it said, you know, she was too beautiful, she was asking for it, you know, she shouldn't have been bathing up there and you know, where I could see her.
Right.
All that stuff. He could just as well, you know, when she said, I am with child, he could have had her killed. He could have just, you know, given her millions of dollars and said, don't you tell anybody.
Right. Or say that it was one of my servants. I mean, it obviously couldn't have been Uriah since he wasn't here, but say it was one of my servants. And I will kill that servant, and that's your story. Here's your millions of dollars. Yes, right.
But Bathsheba is nowhere blamed. And this is why, to extend it to our own day, I get so gripped when people say that, you know, the problem, there's such a huge problem with teenage pregnancies. I say, why don't you just go back to where it belongs and say the problem is teenage fornication?
Yeah, right. Which takes two parties in our day, and especially the way David's society was set up, really only took one party, especially when he was the king and could take whom he wished. Mm-hmm. Bathsheba doesn't have a big part. She's not fleshed out as a human being. We don't know how she felt about all this and how her loyalties may have been conflicted. She's not the central focus, but it would be an interesting novel, or at least a short story, to try to tell this from her point of view, wouldn't it?
There is one.
Is there?
Written by a Swedish author. It's called Bathsheba. It's very interesting. It gives her a large role. And because she stays in the story. Mm-hmm. I mean, she isn't banished from David's life.
Her next child is Solomon, who eventually becomes king after David.
She must
David,
have been important in her own right in some way.
Yeah. Yeah, again, the scripture's not told from the point of view or with much concern for the woman's point of view, but it's something that we can think about and try to fill in from our own experience, which might say, you know, more about us and our society when we do fill in the story. But we learn something about ourselves doing that.
So interesting that the Jesus came from that line.
Yeah. I want to read to you, in the last minutes we have, I want to look at this now and identify with it. Because we've seen in David something that's not just David, it's human. It's wanting to use our power and our resources for ourselves, for that tug of war we feel between the gifts we've been given and what... and what we want to make of those gifts and who we want to use them for. Think of, I'm an American. I can do what I want. I can spend my money the way I want. I earned it. I know there are people hungry and starving all over the world, but I have the right. Our country has worked hard to get this far. I'm going to take advantage of being an American. And for many of us, it's kind of at the same level as it was for David. Not really thought out, it was just the basis on which we operate. No one has ever called into question that we might not deserve the being 5% of the world's population and using 40% of the world's resources, or whatever those figures are, so lopsided. And so our behavior results in commandment breaking on a social scale, as a social system. There's an example I ran across the other day when I was reading The Other Side, which is a magazine that's often available around here. This is an interview with Jonathan Kozol, who's written about American public education for 25 years. His first book was called Death at an Early Age, The Destruction of the Hearts and Minds of Negro Children in the Boston Public Schools. He's also written about illiteracy in America and homelessness in America. His current book is Savage Inequalities, Children in America's Schools. And he just comments this way. When wealthy people in Great Neck, Long Island, send their children to public schools that spend $15,000 a year per pupil, and New York City can afford to spend only $7,000 per pupil for kids with far greater needs, that shows deliberate and conscious unfairness. When those wealthy folks persistently vote against any kind of equalizing of the money, and when in large numbers they support two presidents in sequence who cut federal assistance to public education, allowing it to be cut almost in half in the past 10 years, I consider that deliberate and conscious. I don't mean that the folks out in the suburbs wish poor children ill. They simply want the best for their own kids, and they're not willing to share the pie. Despite a lot of pious rhetoric about equality of opportunity, most parents want their children to have a better than equal opportunity. Inevitably, that means that they want someone else to have a less than equal opportunity. If I talk in a wealthy suburb, someone invariably asks, does money really buy a better education? That was President Bush's famous line last year, dollars don't buy education. But President Bush and the wealthy suburbanites certainly believe it does when it comes to their kids. If not, why don't they send the extra money to the inner cities? There's a lot of talk these days about the pathologies of the inner city, the pathologies of teenage kids causing trouble, violence, gangs. Yet no one ever talks about the pathologies of the very rich, people who are pathologically determined to give their children a virtual exemption from equal competition. I remembered reading that interview when I was thinking about David. We have the money, we can spend it the way we want on our children. Comments? Or other examples, or anybody want to disagree with me?
Yeah, I'd like to disagree. It doesn't set well with me a lot of times when I hear a lot of talk like that, because I think that this nation is really blessed and does more to give to other nations that are poor than any other nation. As opposed to poor, the stuff America and Great Britain do to help the third world country, that I don't think they would have as much help as they do have now. It's pretty hard for a third world country.
The question would have to be, are we giving enough? Are we giving our fair share?
I agree. Maybe we can do more, but I do believe that for the most part, the hearts go out to help the third world countries and the countries that are less poor. But it's very hard for a country that is starving to help another country that's starving. And I think God.
Yeah, for a country that's starving spiritually, as the United States may be, reach very deep in its pockets. You wanted to say.
Well, just when you were reading the figures about public education, I'm from the state of Oregon, and we only spend on average 45 minutes per student.
Yeah. Much less what New York City does.
Well, this article,
just a second.
It really is an interesting thing with the education thing and the whole resources thing within our own country, because that really is a good point about that we do want it. We say we want equal, but we do want better than equal, you know? And I mean, being from the United States, I do feel so blessed, but in the same way, I don't think, you know, I can't say, oh wow, I really want to live in Mexico where I can't have good drinking water and that I won't have the chances that I do to go to a public school or, you know, to be in an inner city even. It really is amazing that we take the better than equal that we have for granted in a lot of ways.
We move from saying blessed to saying entitled. Yeah. No, just you're next. You're next. She's next. You're next.
I was just going to comment, but I think the article, the writer of the article was talking about our children here in America, not the children from other countries.
Right.
I think we have to take care of our own first, as far as, you know, trying to be equal and treat people.
Yeah, his examples are of the inequalities in the American school system.
That was my point.
Yeah.
We're actually changing the subject.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about the differential within the United States.
Yeah.
And trying to justify more money in some places than others.
Yeah.
And the same, it goes, you know, because the more wealthy people have more power.
And like King David?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
And it can be voted down.
I haven't finished reading his book of Savage Inequalities, but there's some very, very telling examples. And it reminds me of the politics involved in my wife's hometown, Butte, Montana, in which there was company property right in the middle of the city, which was not within the city limits and not taxed by the city. These little islands. And this is the same thing that he brings out in the school districts, that they were arranged in such a way that those who had the most money had their own compact little school district. They could spend their money on their children.
Mm-hmm.
The poorer districts were, of course, separated. But the bigger point of it, and as gentleman over there expressed, that the amount of money that we have given, after the Second World War, the Marshall Plan, rebuilding many, many countries. But it isn't just money. If money is all we give, there has to be more with it than just.